Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
We are back. It is another edition of Pollock and Thurston, John Pollock and Brandon Thurston with you. For the next hour, we have a packed edition of the show, bringing you two guests on today's show. Looking forward to speaking to both of our guests, as I am with the man that you see on the right hand of your screen, Brandon Thurston, joining us from WrestleNomics HQ.
Well, for full disclosure, we've already spoken to one of our guests today.
Yeah, we're not going to put anyone under the illusion. This is a taped program. We spoke to Kendra Barkoff Lammy about an hour and a half ago. So we are going to be hearing from her. She is the spokesperson for Janelle Grant. She is with the SKDC group that recently was enlisted by Janelle Grant's team and is working on behalf of them. She was present on the conference call a few weeks ago with Ann Callis, and we're going to be speaking with her about this letter that was issued on Tuesday and sent to members of TKO, WWE, imploring them to release various women from past NDAs that are attached to the company and, of course, Vince McMahon.
And the letter was released to the media, too, so we're going to go into the details of it.
Yeah. So here is the letter that in its entirety. World Wrestling Entertainment has said that it, quote, takes Ms. Grant's allegations very seriously and has no tolerance for any physical abuse or unwanted physical contact. In other words, WWE would like the world to believe that it has reformed its workplace culture. But if WWE is truly committed to change, it must allow survivors to speak their truth without fear of reprisal. We call upon WWE to publicly waive enforcement of its non-disclosure agreements, NDAs, to allow its former and current employees and contractors, including wrestlers contracted to perform under the WWE brand, to speak out about sexual misconduct, sexual assault, harassment, and workplace aggression, or disputes concerning the toxic culture at WWE. This includes releasing women who signed NDAs related to sexual misconduct by former CEO Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and other WWE leadership and employees as conditions of settlement. The toxic and sexualized culture at WWE during Mr. McMahon's tenure as CEO and chairman was open and notorious. Yet what has been publicly reported is only part of the picture. We have had witnesses come to us confidentially and describe a sexualized culture at WWE that victimizes women and men. We have received reports that many victims are currently afraid to come forward because of punitive, non-disclosure, and non-disparagement agreements. For example, as the Wall Street Journal reported on July 8, 2022, Mr. McMahon paid over $12 million to at least four women to secure their silence about his sexual misconduct. Our client is just one of an untold many. We therefore also ask Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis to affirm that survivors and WWE employees who witnessed abuse may speak about their experiences without fear of retribution and retaliation. WWE cannot move on from its sordid past while its victims remain silenced. Survivors deserve an opportunity to share their experiences on their terms. Forced silence only deepens the wounds of sexual abuse. Survivors are re-victimized every time they are muzzled and forced to live in fear of attack from a multi-billion dollar business that can hire an army of lawyers to bury them in legal fees if they speak the truth. Even unenforceable NDAs, like the one our client was coerced to sign, have a chilling effect because individuals do not have the will or resources to fight them. WWE must clarify that any NDAs that it has entered are not intended to prevent disclosure of sexual misconduct, abuse, or assault, and disclaim and waive any claims it may have under those NDAs if current or former employees and contractors choose to speak out. And it ends by stating, we urge WWE to quickly and proactively release its current and former employees and contractors from any obligations under any WWE-executed NDA that would prevent them from discussing sexual misconduct, abuse, or assault during their time at WWE without delay. WWE wants people to believe the company has changed. This is its chance to prove it.
Yes, it's a new era.
It's a new era, yes. And if it's a new era, then we have to put all of the old era under a microscope and focus on this. We have reached out to WWE. To no one's surprise, they have not addressed this. I don't know if they will. They could. thing.
We did reach out to Vince McMahon's representatives, and we were referred to an earlier quote from Vince McMahon's attorney, Jessica Rosenberg, who said earlier, and they're sort of giving you this comment for this situation too, quote, Ms. Grant's claims are false, defamatory, and entirely without merit. We intend to vigorously defend Mr. McMahon and are confident that he will be vindicated, end quote.
Yeah, and I mean, this could very well be a powder keg. Like, yes, in this letter, it is outlined that the four NDAs that we are aware of from the Wall Street Journal reporting, the belief we have that Rita Chatterton signed one that would prohibit her from speaking about her allegation in 1986. To say nothing, Brandon, of what level of NDAs would go back decades when we're talking about the Ring Boy scandal. Other people, like, I don't think anyone would be going out on a limb to think that these NDAs that are out there go much further than just those five that are at least known.
Right.
Without going too speculative, but.
Yeah. Without getting too much into the feedback that we've seen to the story, what would be the incentive if you're WWE, and what is the logic that you would walk through to come to a conclusion that, yes, we will waive these NDAs and we will not enforce them, if, which we'll get into with the conversation that we had with Kendra Barkoff-Lammy, if WWE is even a party to all of these NDAs, at least the ones that we know about, we don't know for sure. In the case of the Grant NDA, yes, WWE and Vince McMahon are parties to the NDA. You would think that for at least some of these, particularly the ones that have been disclosed as part of the Wall Street Journal reporting and that were part of the board's investigation, you'd think that WWE is a party to those as well, given that they had to eventually correct their financial statements because these were NDAs that were decided that these benefited the company as well as Vince. They were secret until now. Where was I going with this? What would be the logic? Yeah.
If I'm WWE, I don't think they are going to make this happen. The one incentive I could see would be if they, and we'll get into this in the interview, if they would be demonstrating a tangible step that we are trying to correct the errors of the past, and in turn, they would be let off of this lawsuit, which would give WWE the ability, whenever the name Janelle Grant is uttered or Vince McMahon is uttered, they can state that, listen, we are no longer part of this suit, and that is concerning Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis, and we are removed from this. Because as long as they are a defendant on this case, it's fair game to look at WWE and their own involvement here. That, to me, would be the only incentive. But with it comes a revisiting of all of these different stories, many of which, like, we don't know the full details of, and they're probably horrific if the fact is that an NDA was required.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember how much the Grant story, we didn't know her name until January of this year when her 67-page complaint was put out in all of its graphic detail. Up until then, I think a lot of people assumed that this was just a consensual affair, but that maybe she felt that she was mistreated, and we didn't have any idea, at least, of the allegations that she has details, which include rape, which include coercion, control, everything that she's putting into the complaint. So who knows what these other stories may involve.
But there's a big difference once you have a name and a face attached to these allegations. It just seems like that is a part of the public's concern with some of these, is when you put a name and a face to it, that does change public perception in terms of this. It's not as though the allegations are forgotten about, but like, we rarely hear these, if you go back to that July 2022 report from the Wall Street Journal, like, it's some pretty damning allegations in there, like coercion for sex, terrible, but it's because it's anonymous. I don't think the public latches on to the depth of where these allegations go beyond Janelle Grant, that has been such a public face attached to this.
Yeah, and the story that came up on Tuesday morning in the AP Associated Press, that's pretty big. That's a wire service. There's also been an opinion column in USA Today. I haven't seen any other mainstream coverage of this yet. And usually the thing that makes WWE respond to
ESPN picked up the AP story, but they wasn't. They did pick up the AP story. I saw a fair bit of coverage attached to this, but I think that was kind of the AP leading the way on this, the fact that it was a story on the Associated Press that we have seen. So we wanted to speak with Kendra Barkoff-Lamy. Again, she is one of the spokespersons for Janelle Grant, and we are going to run that interview. Again, this was conducted just under 2 hours ago, so not live, but close to live. But here is Kendra Barkoff-Lamy joining us on Pollock and Thurston. Welcome back to the show, and joining us now, she is a former press secretary for Joe Biden from 2011 to 2015, has worked extensively with survivors in the high-profile cases involving Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, and Matt Lauer. She is now the managing director at SKDK, who are representing Janelle Grant, and a very interesting story coming down over the last 24 hours. But a pleasure to welcome Kendra Barkoff-Lamy to the program. And Kendra, thank you so much for joining us here on Pollock and Thurston today.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your background and how you were brought on by Janelle Grant's team, which was recently announced?
Sure, I'd love to. It is truly an honor to be working with Janelle and her team. She is someone who's experienced a deep trauma and is still working through it. But in terms of my background, I as you mentioned, I have done a lot of work in the survivor area. I represented the Harvey Weinstein survivors, Epstein survivors, the brave and courageous woman who came out against Matt Lauer. I also worked with all the former employees of the Washington Commanders. I'm sure many of your listeners know who Dan Snyder is and the former Washington Redskins that sort of slowly evolved into the Washington Commanders, and worked with those employees for probably almost 4 years to change the culture within that organization by eventually getting Dan Snyder to sell the team. And that took a long time, but I think what I have come to learn as working with all of these survivors in this space is, in order to change the culture within any of these organizations, it has to be sort of a holistic approach to going at it.
Just working in so many of these high profile cases, I mean, do you see certain parallels between a lot of these figures and now somebody like a Vince McMahon as you're going through this case, like any, just from your experience that you draw from as you approach something just of this magnitude of what's alleged?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. I appreciate you asking that. This is all about an abuse of power. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, this is about people who believe they are powerful and can do whatever they want. And most of the time it comes out on women. Sometimes it does affect men as well. And we saw that with the Washington Commanders specifically. There were former employees that were bullied. But this fundamentally comes down to this abuse of power and what they think that they can get away with. And until, again, sort of you go in and change and get them to sell a company or an organization or become more transparent. Sunlight, I think, is sort of the best way to do that. Ultimately, nothing will end up changing. And so that's my goal here.
And reading the letter from Ann Callis that was put out yesterday requesting that the parties who were involved in the civil lawsuit release anyone from NDAs who may have allegations of misconduct. Can you say, are you hearing from people specifically who have worked in WB in the past who are bound to NDAs who do wish to speak out publicly about their experience?
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal, I'm sure you guys saw a piece earlier this year, reported that there were at least four settlements totaling $12 million to former employees over these same similar issues, sexual assault in the workplace, sexual harassment in the workplace. And so, you know, there were at least those four. We have heard sort of anecdotally from others that there are additional NDAs out there. But what happens a lot of time, and I will just clarify for the record, I am not a lawyer. I did not go to law school. So I'm speaking from sort of personal experience and what I've seen is that a lot of times these women don't even, and men too, don't even feel like they can say, and part of what their NDAs do say is you can't even acknowledge that you have an NDA to begin with. I don't know what any of these other NDAs say, but a lot of times they'll say, you know, if somebody picks up the phone and calls them to ask them about their experience working at the WWE, the person will say, I can't even talk, and sort of hang up the phone. So that happens a lot of times. I know that Janelle's legal team has heard from former employees about their experience within the WWE, and they themselves, even most recently, up until a couple of days ago, have heard from former employees just about this sort of toxic work environment that existed within the WWE and could potentially, we don't know what's going on now, which is part of the reason why we are asking for them to sort of open up their doors, allow these women and potentially men to speak freely, to waive these NDAs. If they have nothing to hide, if they claim that they've turned a page on this abuse, on this toxic workplace, then let these people speak about their experience so that they can sort of move on from there.
And beyond waiving the NDAs, are there any other specific reforms or changes that you think WWE should consider doing to improve their working environment?
I mean, I think that this is the first step in what they need to do. I mean, we all saw the documentary, the Vince McMahon documentary. I think he obviously was the, you know, a big problem within the WWE, but you know, we are, a lot of the same people are still there. They are still working at that organization who are around when Ms. Grant experienced what she experienced. And so, again, until we truly know sort of the breadth and the depth of the problem, we won't be able to understand how, as a culture, we can sort of move forward and fix it.
Now, to the best of your knowledge, these NDAs, to release these women from them, would that require any sign-off from Vince McMahon for these NDAs to be to waive the enforceability of them?
I mean, that's what the letter exactly says that they want. WWE and Vince McMahon. It is hard to know who signed what because, again, there's this little like, you know, who actually signed what and when and all of those pieces. Again, we do know that folks have signed them and that there are out there, but without knowing what the NDAs say, it's a little speculative on who signed which individual NDA.
And thinking back to, so what's in the complaint that was filed by Janelle Grant in January, there are a number of corporate officers who were referred to. Several months ago, we reported that the four corporate officers are the WWE president, Nick Khan, and three executives who are no longer with the company, Brad Blum, Stephanie McMahon, and Brian Nurse. So Nick Khan is still the lead executive with WWE. And one question that gets raised to us often is, you know, when it's Nick Khan, who was an executive when Janelle Grant was with the company, he was, though, below Vince on the org chart, although Nick was a member of the board of directors and still is. What's your view about in the corporate environment? What does an executive in that sort of position, what responsibility does that person have to protect employees, and what can they do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great question. As outlined in her complaint, right, she is suing both Vince McMahon and WWE. As a company and as an organization, as a company, you have an obligation to protect your employees. And so if there were people that were there now or are still there now who knew about the abuse that was going on and did nothing about it, that's a problem. And you can be held, you should and can be held responsible for that. So Nick obviously was still there at that time. Triple H was around at that time. And so there are still people that are within the organization now currently who were there at that time.
From the WWE's perspective, you're stating that this would be a good first step for them to show contrition, to show that this is a new culture that they are fostering. If they met a certain level, is Janelle Grant open to dropping WWE from this case? Like, where is, for WWE's perspective, like, they have done so much to distance themselves from Vince McMahon that waiving these NDAs, it will bring about all of this negative publicity for them as well. So just trying to get into their heads to incentivize this beyond just wanting to, you know, clean up this very, very ugly mess that this company's history has on its resume.
Yeah, and if they want to clean up this mess, then they should allow these women to speak freely and these former employees to speak freely at the end of the day. I mean, everybody has read the lawsuit, the complaint. It is very detailed in her allegations. And there is a reason why she's going after the organization as a whole. It is because, again, as an organization, as a company, you are responsible for protecting your employees. And so, you know, at the current time, her lawsuit is in a stay. The federal government asked her to just sort of hang tight as they do their investigation into Vince McMahon. So that's sort of where she's at. There's nothing that's happening on her current lawsuit. And so she's in a little bit of this kind of holding pattern, sort of waiting. But in the meantime, I think that's part of the reason why even now it's more important and why she, you know, wanted to send this letter to sort of show that this sunlight is the best sort of disinfectant. And let's get in there. If you guys say that this was all Mr. McMahon's doing, that there was, you know, no one else within the organization participated in any of these activities, then great. Then put it back on him and show that that was him and that there's no other issues. But we can't know that until they themselves are become transparent and allow these people to speak.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that this letter, a copy of it was sent to not only WWE executives, but to Ari Emanuel as well, who is the CEO of Endeavor and TKO, which is for people who might not know that that is the parent company of WWE. Now they merged in 2023. And one comment from Ari Emanuel that I think is meaningful to this conversation is he was criticizing his rival talent agency CAA at a conference in October. You know, saying that the lead executives at CAA had been supportive of Harvey Weinstein, and things like that. He said, quote, they should take a leave of absence and investigators should come in and they should look at what they did. They didn't apologize. They didn't deny it. So from my perspective, it's horrific, end quote. So he's taking issue with a rival talent organization. It seems to speak to his objection to sexual misconduct in the workplace for one thing. And how do you see, you know, that sort of, ethical standard being applied here?
You know, it's really interesting. It's a great question. In California, they have in the federal government, there's a law called the Speak Out Act, and it has to do with passed by Congress, signed into law a few years ago. And it basically allows for if you have an NDA dealing with these issues, sort of post the law being signed into law, you can speak freely about your experiences. And so in California specifically, they have an even stronger and more stringent law, which says if you have been sexually assaulted or sexually harassed in the workplace, you can go to your HR department, you can go to sort of the leadership and say, I want to speak freely about my experiences. That law is not passed everywhere. So only California has it. I think New York has something kind of similar to it. So stronger, maybe New Jersey, stronger laws that are in place to protect the employee should something happen to them while in the workplace. And so, you know, one thing that Ari Emanuel and Endeavor could do is to say, you know, we believe, you know, because we own WWE and we believe so strongly that employees should have the ability to speak up about their experiences in the workplace, that whatever law applies in California should apply in Connecticut as well. And these employees that have experienced things or have NDAs in Connecticut, we're going to take whatever law sort of applies here and say, even though it's not the law in Connecticut, they can speak freely. So, you know, he can put his money where his mouth is, so to speak, a little bit too, because as you mentioned, Endeavor does inevitably own the WWE.
Yeah. And we did reach out yesterday evening to spokespeople for WWE and Endeavor. We haven't heard anything, which is their normal non-response to this. They usually do not comment on this. I think they've only given at least one comment on a written article. And that was for when we were reporting on who the anonymized officers were. Is your response to their effort to try to ignore this basically? And what I think fans have seen a lot of is, especially at WrestleMania this year, sort of a bringing forward of who the new leaders are. Nick Khan making a small appearance on screen and Paul Levesque being heavily featured. It's sort of a, we've moved on from Vince McMahon kind of message and we're trying to avoid any direct addressing of the issue.
Yeah, and I'm sure they are, right? I'm sure they're not probably thrilled that they got this letter yesterday and they got a lot of calls from reporters. But not responding is actually the worst way to deal with it, right? There's a way that you can say, okay, we're going to either open our doors or we're going to review the letter, we're going to do something. And my general sense is you're right. They don't tend to respond to, you know, these kinds of things, but that doesn't mean we're not going to continue to try to push for what is right. I mean, that is the whole reason why Ms. Grant came forward to begin with, to sort of tell her story and tell what happened, because she believes that there are others that also deserve to be able to speak about their experience.
I just wanted to go quickly back to you. You do mention the Netflix series that recently came out on Vince McMahon, and it is like not an insignificant subject that we have seen sometimes these mass produced documentaries, whether the recent ones on the Menendez brothers, you go back to the Jinx on HBO, that these series have sometimes led to real actions being taking place. Do you feel that the Netflix series is an overall positive just to awareness of this story? And how did you feel that the aspects of this case were represented in the series?
We're obviously glad that they included Ms. Grant's case in the first and the last episode. It's really important, I think, because it does frame and it does show even more so who Vince McMahon was and is as a person. It is a good thing. I think it has brought a lot more interest. Obviously, there's a lot of people who love WWE and follow it very closely. There's a lot of people who, you know, have followed Mr. McMahon's career and what he has done. But those kinds of documentaries, especially it reaches sort of a mass audience that frankly may not have known about Ms. Grant's case, what she experienced. And so it does reach a new and different audience that I think is really, really important. And the more people that know about what has happened to her and what has happened, you know, what happened while at the WWE, the better off it is.
Yeah, and at the media call that was held by yourself and Ann Callis a few weeks ago, I know there was a lot of mentioning of Janelle having, she'll have her opportunities sometime to tell her story. Is there anything you could share at this time about how or when that might happen?
No, we're still trying to figure that out. I think there will be a time and there will be a place for her to tell it in her own words in a way that she is, you know, feels really good about. But I don't have any announcements at this point in time.
And I just wanted to end things off speaking about Janelle, because I feel so much that we get away from the fact that this is a human being involved in a lot of this. And I'm curious as well, just the amount of work you're doing directly with Janelle and how she is doing over these past months where this has become such a major story. And inevitably, it's got to be one that she's carrying a lot of weight and stress from.
Yeah, I mean, it is not easy. I think on the call, her lawyer, Ann Callis, talked about how she still is very much in a sort of feeling the post-trauma of what she experienced. You know, there's a lot of issues that she's still working through. But let me tell you, she is a strong, courageous woman. She is here for the fight. She is here to sort of take this and make sure that the proceedings go the way that they need to go in order for, you know, Mr. McMahon and WWE to be held accountable. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't be doing what she's doing. And I give her so much respect. I have so much admiration for her because it's got to be hard getting up each and every day, knowing that sort of what you experience. And if your viewers read the complaint, I mean, it is the stuff that she did experience as a person is just horrific. I mean, you could never imagine the stuff that she experienced on your worst enemy. And so, you know, the fact that she does get up each and every day is just a tribute to who she is and what a wonderful person she is.
And I just add, given that this is like a wrestling centric show, if there are females that might be watching this that have experience in the WWE and maybe they do want to speak up, is there anywhere you could direct them toward if there are people out there that maybe like they have had their own experience that they've kept to themselves?
Yeah, we would obviously love to hear from you in whatever way you feel comfortable doing so. We have an entire legal team we're working with. Holland Trial Lawyers is sort of the legal entity. I'm at SKDK. We're a DC-based public relations firm. Happy to talk to any survivors who feel like they want to tell their story in some way, shape, or form. Happy to connect them with attorneys. I still hear from survivors on a regular basis, sort of across the board in various industries and walks of life, and sort of happy to have that preliminary conversation. And no pressure, obviously. If you feel like the time is right and you want to have that conversation, great. If you're not ready to, that's okay as well.
Well, Kendra, thank you so much for coming on, keeping us updated on the case, and we wish you all the best moving forward.
Thank you guys for covering it. It's really important and appreciate it.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
All right. That was Kendra Barkoff Lammy joining us from SKDK and representing Janelle Grant. And yeah, a lot covered in there that we had gone over from the letter, what the expectations are, and also a reaction to the Netflix series, which I think everyone can agree has given a renewed spotlight to this entire case. And while Janelle Grant was not in the series, there was time dedicated to it. And it does feel that there is a, there certainly does seem to be a tact of putting a more aggressive stance, behind this as they are in the midst of this stay and this letter also representing that movement towards, more transparency and being able to eliminate some of these NDAs, as she explained.
Yeah. And just to mention the detail that this case is at right now, as you mentioned, it's on a stay, and the date that it was stayed until is December 11th. And why is it being stayed? It's being stayed at the request of U.S. attorneys from the Southern District of New York, who are presumably involved in a federal investigation, criminal investigation, potentially involving, according to the Wall Street Journal in February, involving allegations of sexual assault and sex trafficking against Vince McMahon. So we don't know if there's going to be any action taken on that, but this case is stayed. They have not gotten to discovery. The civil lawsuit at the moment was being argued by the defendants that it should go to arbitration consistent with the arbitration clause that was in the NDA contract. So that's where it is. I've seen some feedback about how that discovery must not be going well or something like that when discovery has not happened yet, at this point at all.
Yeah. I mean, they pretty much can, like, they are kind of hands off at this point during this day in terms of anything active being worked upon in terms of the case. So again, a thank you to Kendra for joining us. Obviously, we're going to be continuing to follow this, and if WWE opts to respond or address it, we will certainly convey that. We have a lot of other stories to get to. This isn't even the lead story, but this week, Brandon Thurston has determined who owns AEW.
I heard there was a big EW news story last week that you and I haven't spoken. Well, we did. We did on a pre-Dynamite, right? Post-Dynamite.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That happened last week. If you missed it, there's been a renewal at WBD, mm-hmm. Dynamite, Collision, and more programming to be determined.
AEW is not going out of business for now, at least.
It's not. It is going to be profitable.
You think it's going to be profitable? John Pollock is saying that.
Yes, I am saying that.
Okay.
AEW is going to be profitable.
I think it is too.
No reporters have any percentage in this company. I can also say that definitively. We'll move on. And yes. I will say that with 100% certainty.
But to Brandon, my knowledge, that is not true. Yes.
Yes. Tell us who Beatnik Investments LLC are.
Well, if you remember your history course in reading all the old newsletters, and they would refer to from the years of whatever the 80s through about 1999 when WWE was went public and became WWFE, everyone referred to the World Wrestling Federation as Titan. And I'm moving now for the style book to revise itself so that we now, whenever we are referring to All Elite Wrestling, we refer to it as Beatnik. What do you think?
I'm going to definitely assign it. Yeah. Yeah. That we could call it the Jacksonville office. That was always a weird one as WWF. They just adopted New York when its base of operations was never in New York proper.
No, but
Connecticut never got any love.
That was their main market though.
It was, but you know, Gotta. Where could I send my billing towards Titan Sports? It was not in New York, but nonetheless,
Connecticut. Yes.
So yes, we have learned that the overarching entity is Beatnik Investments LLC, and also coming out of this Kevin Kelly Tate's case against AEW, Tony Khan and Ian Riccaboni, that they would have had to disclose any ownership above 10%, and they did not have to list, like, whatever you want to believe about WBD's stake in AEW, it would not exceed 10%, or else they would have had to disclose that.
Yes. So this is actually not new news. This was this Beatnik Investments being the parent company of AEW, which it is, that this was actually disclosed just over a year ago as part of the, do you remember the Luchasaurus mask lawsuit?
Yes.
Where the designer of the Luchasaurus mask was suing AEW because they were claiming that this was their copyrighted work that AEW was profiting from. And in any case, in a federal lawsuit, presumably you have to make a disclosure like this about what your parent companies are and if any publicly traded company owns at least 10% or more of your company. And they did disclose this back in August. But it is interesting in the context of AEW's new TV deal, where there has been discussion and even I would say implied reporting by Sports Business Journal that WBD has some sort of equity stake, minority equity stake in AEW. Now, this indicates that if they do at all, which they may not, but if they do, that it's less than 10%. So that's what we know. What is Beatnik Investments? It is a limited liability company that that Shad Khan previously used around 2017 in his major investment into the Black News Channel, which was a project that eventually filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Media mogul Byron Allen bought it. It was used for Shad Khan's investment in that. Now appears, according to Florida company filings, it appears to be controlled by Tony Khan and his sister Shanna Khan, I think is how you say her name. So it's controlled by his kids now. I have looked into Ring of Honor. Is this the parent company of Ring of Honor too? And it's Ring of Honor, according to Florida filings, has it yet a different parent company, ARK Capital Partners? I could not figure out what that was other than these are things controlled by the Khan family.
Okay. Well, that is the latest. If you want to hear more about this case, last week we had lawyer Stephen New on the program, and personally, this is me speaking. I'm not going to speak on behalf of Brandon. We received a lot of feedback to this interview last week, positive, negative. My one thing is that I'm going to convey to people that the guests that we have on this show, yes, they're not always going to be in line with everyone's approval. That's a given. But I am definitely not going to run from guests that it might be, you know, not to your satisfaction. I thought it was a very relevant, newsworthy guest that Brandon and I both agreed on ahead of time to have on. And I think for a case like this, I appreciate a Stephen New coming on the show. So you may disagree with them, but I find to just like dismiss something before you even hear it. Like, by all means, if you think that we whiff on an interview, by all means, I'm open to that criticism. But I saw a lot of that last week, and I didn't have any hesitation about this interview, and I was very happy with the interview that we conducted last week. But those are my two cents.
The only negative response I saw was before the interview, what happened, right? It was when we said we're going to do it, which we did do it on this program live. This is a very paranoid age when it comes to media, right? And I think, so we did book Stephen Pinu 9 days before we did the interview with him, which was before we anticipated that there would be on that day, news of AEW's renewal with WBD. So there are some people thinking that this was all a plot and a plan.
What a plot.
to disseminate negative news about AEW on the day of its big positive news. And that we were, of course, as we agreed to in the dark, smoky room earlier, that we would disseminate such negative news about AEW.
Yeah. Listen, I understand that paranoia comes with the territory sometimes, but I hope people that consume myself and Brandon's work realize that we are coming at this in good faith. But that doesn't mean we are not going to have people on that maybe are at odds with your line of thinking or this idea that we're just going to have people on that everyone is going to be in sync with opinions. I think great discussions come out of disagreements or differences of opinion. I think we need more of that and not less of it. So anyway, that is John Pollock's soapbox for the week.
I'm just add, I'm all for it. You know, we're all fair game here to criticize.
Absolutely.
The media.
I am not by any means trying to be like, hey, don't criticize us.
If I can make a request, though, criticize me and us for what we actually do and say, not just for the associations that you can point out or the timing of things.
Yes.
I know that's hard to do.
It sometimes is. Let's shift on over to this story from the great state of Oklahoma, who on Tuesday held a commission hearing. And Brandon, you have been on top of this story, and this goes back to earlier this year when AEW received a warning after a December show last year where Nyla Rose competed on. The commission was made aware of this and issued a warning to AEW that this did go against their rules that prohibited male versus female professional wrestling matches. To our knowledge, they were not fined, but they were given the warning.
Yes. Yes. And we have public records showing that. Yes.
They did run a show in February. That's the last time AEW has run in the state. Nyla Rose was not on that show. They have not run since. They do not have anything on the calendar for Oklahoma. But after a hearing in July, it was this topic was going to be addressed on Tuesday. And thankfully, we had several members of the pro wrestling community there that were in attendance, including our guest Logan Knight, who not only attended, but he got us video of what was going on, getting us right into this commission hearing. And Logan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
I kind of felt watching the videos that you posted this morning, that this was almost a time warp. I felt like at a certain point I needed to remind myself this is 2024. But it seems like I don't think I'm going out on a limb to assume there was frustration in the room on your behalf and others.
Yeah, there was definitely a ton of frustration, especially after I think the most frustration I could gauge in the room was immediately after they had voted to take things to legislation, instead of making a decision themselves, they went on to vote on if they should have bare knuckle boxing fights in Oklahoma or not. And they just got done preaching that they want to ensure the safety of everybody in professional wrestling, but then they go and they legitimize bare knuckle boxing, which seems kind of against safety when you think about it. I tried to explain to them, I'm a professional wrestler that has about 60 to 100 matches in a year, and I'd be really, really impressed that if you could find a professional fighter, like an actual, you know, combat sports fighter that does 60 to 100 fights in a year and isn't some sort of vegetable.
And Logan, to your understanding, they totally had the power to change this rule. And in fact, you were at a meeting in July, is that correct? Where it looked like there was going to be some sort of change.
Yeah, the meeting in July was originally supposed to be for the vote on the male versus female ruling, but they had a lot of stuff brought to their attention as far as just like all the national attention I got and the emails they were getting from various people trying to explain to them why the rulings they had were wrong. So they decided to push the voting back to October. But in July, it really did seem like they were on our side. But now it kind of just seems like they don't want anything to do with it because it seems like it's either too delicate of a conversation for them or they simply just don't know what they're doing.
How much like it was brought up several times about the concern about making this a political issue. How much of that aspect do you feel is being focused upon that this, a lot of this focuses on Nyla Rose, a transgender performer, as opposed to if this had come out of a match that, like, how much of that issue do you think is the lightning rod for these commission members that have leaned them towards this hesitancy to make a strict ruling?
I think originally, since that was the topic of conversation, being the intergender rule and then the transgender rule, that was the original conversation. I feel like it's evolved now after hearing the conversations we were having at the commission meeting yesterday. It feels like at first they were trying to be understanding and that they could see that we cared enough to show up and do civic duty and, you know, try and get these rules changed. But it seemed like that got lost somewhere. And I don't want to say that we only care about the intergender ruling or the transgender ruling, because in all honesty, I also care about them just not looking at professional wrestling as a sport. Mm-hmm. I know we all try to say that, you know, a lot of this can be real. A lot of it, I mean, it's physical punishment and, you know, real things can happen in a wrestling ring, but it doesn't pose the same threat as a combat sport or another, like any other given athletic event, because there's always almost a guarantee of physical danger. And in professional wrestling, accidents happen just like any other line of work. So I feel like they're focusing too much on the gender issue as opposed to redefining and rewriting their means and rules of what professional wrestling is, because I don't want to disband the commission. I mean, they're people with jobs that just have to do their job like the rest of us. So I understand a little bit where they're coming from, but at the same time, they don't understand what they're governing. And if there's a way to revise what the rules are, I want to take that approach, because if you look at the NBA, the NFL, any other major sporting league, they have a players association or a rules committee that comes together every offseason and discusses the rules of the association and the rules of the game. And I think that, I mean, we can take that same approach with professional wrestling. The last time the rules were written for professional wrestling were 20 years ago.
And one thing I would add to that, in addition to concerns that people raise about safety when we're talking about having transgender people involved in sports, is that there's also no issue about protecting, you know, the sacredness of the competition. It's not like, it's not like there's any legitimate concern when it's pro wrestling and all the matches are predetermined. The winners and losers are booked by the booker ahead of time.
Can you also just share with us, Logan, for those that maybe are not familiar, specific to Oklahoma and wrestling in that state, what are some of the measures you do have to go through under that specific commission? And my thought has always been, like, I am not anti-commission when it comes to pro wrestling. I think that there are certain avenues when it comes to health and safety that can be implemented. The problem is when, to your point, it's them governing something they don't truly understand. There can be a lot of overreach, and this feeling like a prime example of that.
Yeah, I think they do offer up services like they have us get blood work once a year, and then they also make us get a physical, which I think the physical is really important, because a couple of years ago we had a kid who was training on Native American ground. Well, I guess this is more like almost a decade ago now, but we had a kid that was training on Native American ground, which is unsanctioned by the Oklahoma State Athletic Commission. So he was not required to get a physical, and even though he seemed in great health, he wasn't obese or fat or anything, he did training just fine. He had a few matches and then had a heart attack and passed away because no one knew that he had a heart murmur, not even himself. And so there's instances like that that really make you think, hey, we should have some sort of protocol or something for this. And the commission does. It's the physical. A lot of people like the blood work aspect because, you know, you never know how clean somebody is. And I agree. And I know some of the performers, they think it just makes them feel more safe. In my personal opinion, I think blood work is only as good as the day you get it. You never know when a person can get, you know, a bloodborne illness. And so it's just really how much you want to trust it. And people just seem safer with that around. So I think the commission does offer good services like that. But when they send inspectors and stuff to shows, they usually just check the licenses and leave. They don't stay there for the whole show to make sure that the rules are actually enforced. So you can have a show where there is intergender matches as long as you don't, you know, advertise it. If you have it on the back half of your card, you're likely fine because they're not going to see it. And so I feel like it's a lot of, I guess, just, I don't want to say do your job, but like make sure everything thoroughly is getting done, because there's a lot of people that are taking avenues and shortcuts, not even at the highest level of the commission, but even at the lower level, like the inspectors, that is making everyone look bad.
And it was interesting as well in the meeting that one of the commissioners, Rick Garrett, this is a former pro wrestler. So it's not as though they don't have a representative on the commission that does understand this industry.
Yes, and that's also something I spoke on during my public forum speaking time, is that I understood that Rick was already a wrestler and on their board, but it seems like that maybe their opinions they have are outdated, and that's nothing against Rick. Rick got to actually wrestle females in his time in Oklahoma during the 80s and 90s, and so it seemed a little backwards to me that we all of a sudden have this rule, and there's not really a reason that anyone can point as to why we have that rule. I suggested, like I had spoke earlier, that we just need to, you know, take a look at the times. The last time the rules were revised or looked at in Oklahoma were 20, 23 years ago, something like that. And I'm 25, so that's like most of my life. So I think that the rules need to at least get looked at and, you know, thought about, because they try to speak in terms of professional wrestling still being under the same branch as traditional wrestling, like you would see in school or college level or at the Olympics. What made me really upset with that is that they gave false numbers at this commission meeting, trying to say that 22 states have professional wrestling, you know, under a commission, and that's not true. There's only about 10 or 11 that actually have professional wrestling under a commission, maybe 12 or 13. I did a lot of digging for that, and they're trying to say that six of these states only ban intergender, which is also not true, because they're talking about school wrestling. They're not talking about professional wrestling. There needs to be a line drawn in the sand, because they're putting us under the same rules and regulations as that type of wrestling, when it's not the same. And we've offered them times to come to training to see that the women get trained the same as the men, and to see, you know, the safety protocols behind each and every maneuver or, you know, thing we do. And they just seem to not even want to play ball. I've offered to pay for their tickets and travel to come up to a show in Wichita, which is only 2 hours from Oklahoma City, to see me and my tag team partner Stormy Renee have intergender matches. And while they seemed like that was a good idea in the meeting, they never reached out. And when I reached out to, you know, give them those comp tickets, nothing was responded. So
do they understand that wrestling is a work?
That's what we're getting at the back in July, this was about the intergender rule. This was about the mistreatment of Nyla Rose and the transgender people, and it still is. But now, after the meeting yesterday and the rhetoric and the conversation and the words that were used, they just don't know what they're talking about. And I'm not even saying that in a disrespectful sense. I'm just saying it in the sense of, like, I feel like they were just given pro wrestling and told deal with it, and then didn't look further into it.
Yeah, I think it comes from this earlier time where these commissions were created decades and decades ago, when there was more mystery and mystique around wrestling, and it was protected as real. And now we've evolved into this modern day where it's basically openly a work, and yes. But there's still the government entities still exist, and jobs, you know, have to be justified, I guess.
And that's an interesting conversation I had with someone yesterday. It felt kind of wrong to say, just because of how the wrestling community is trained and brought up to protect kayfabe. But we had a conversation about how kayfabe is now potentially doing more harm to the business than it is good, at least in a sense like this, when you have governments thinking that this is real.
Yeah. And sometimes, like, the root of these problems to communicate comes from a financial aspect. And you have to wonder how deterred AEW is from running the state, because if all things are equal, to go to the state and not use a Nyla Rose, I think it's scrutiny AEW will face, and yes. You're preventing the number two company from running. Like, they have not run there since February. And I don't know what the incentive is, as long as this rule is on the books, that they are to come into the state and abide by it. I think AEW would feel it would reflect poorly on them with their fan base.
And I would add just to that AEW, while their attendance isn't great these days, but it would be supplying some sort of minor economic impact to have, you know, your venue, I think it's Paycom, to be run one more time. And that would provide work for a day for a lot of people.
And I think people also miss, like, the overarching reach that AEW has by going to a small town. Like, Oklahoma City is a big town, but it's also not that big, and it's definitely not great for a wrestling hub. And when AEW comes to these towns, AEW is a lot more giving to matches to indie guys around here than WWE would be. And it's a chance for talent around here to be seen. And so when we have commissions like this, having rules like this, it makes companies not want to come back. And so now we have the number two company in the country not wanting to do business here and taking away potential opportunities for wrestlers that, quite frankly, deserve it. There's a lot of very talented wrestlers here in Oklahoma.
Well, Logan, where are things left off from this? Like, it sounds like they just kind of have punted this to the legislature. Like, were you guys given, in the video, it kind of felt like you guys were there, and it was, we appreciate you for coming, but you guys didn't really leave with anything substantial.
Yeah. So to my understanding, they are going to mock something up to give the legislature, but we were also told after the meeting that they're not entirely sure what measures they need to take, because this is going to be a first at bat for them kind of thing too. Like, they haven't had to go back and do this or revise any rules of professional wrestling before. So they're not too sure of the protocols. So they told me to email them back in a week to get a full kind of, like, idea of what they're going to do. But a lot of us that were at the meeting have already communicated with senators and some representatives here in our state to try and figure out what we can do on our own and to bring it in front of legislature or even in front of a judge that can make a difference, because there was a court ruling earlier this year that the commission lost against the judge on Native American land because he ruled professional wrestling as entertainment and not sport. So I'm hoping any other like-minded judge would be able to hop on board and we'd be able to get this in front of the right eyes, because I know as soon as this is in front of an agency or governing body that can handle this situation that isn't the commission, we'll probably get what we want. Any other person that I've talked to about this seems to have the same consensus of, well, it's fake, right? So do they really have any jurisdiction at all? And that's what I'm starting to wonder too, is professional wrestling actually anywhere in the rules to be sanctioned as a sport? Like Vince McMahon, he had it federally recognized as sports entertainment back in the 80s or 90s. And so how did we get here? I'm just amazed that nobody can answer me on how we got here.
And what you're moving for now is that specifically to have the legislator look at the question of gender in wrestling or some larger deregulation of wrestling in the state?
I would say the deregulation completely of professional wrestling. I do think the commission offers a service, and if they're willing to still, you know, offer a medical service like that to us just to make us feel safer and to, you know, get their kicks off, I guess is what this is at the end of the day, that's fine. But I just want them to understand what professional wrestling is. If they exist at the end of this, that's fine too. I just wish they knew what it was and had rules accordingly based on what professional wrestling is.
Well, if you want to go and watch the hearing that went down on Tuesday, you can follow Logan at Logan Knight Pro on X. He's got two videos up, and including quite the statement right off the bat by Lucian Lovelace that all of you guys followed as well. He had I think his line was, "You guys have gotten so in the weeds, you've created new weeds," which was quite the observation.
That's one of my best friends. Lucian is quite the talker. He really gave it to him.
You guys had some very good speeches on this, and you know, kudos to all of you guys for like taking the time out to go to actually record this as well. I know it can probably be a frustrating process, but I think this kind of transparency to see it in the video form, I think it really does give you the context of what you guys are up against here.
Yeah, because up until now, it's just been stories and quotes, and you know, Fox News giving statements from myself or my trainer Brandon Groom, but. Now we have all of this on video and posted. I was able to post snippets and like little 2-minute clips from the last commission meeting on my social media, but it didn't really embody the overarching sense of just, we don't know what's going on here type of feeling. That was
local Fox News, right? Your local Fox affiliate.
Yes. I guess now, I mean, hey, that's like 3 or 4 interviews. I think I need to be like sponsored or something.
just to clarify, Fox News, the cable network, has not picked this up yet. I don't think.
Not yet. Maybe they'll get on top of it.
Yes.
Well, Logan, thanks so much for taking some time out to chat with us. We're going to be following this story, and again, you know, we credit you for, you know, going out and kind of waging this battle, because I can imagine it's a frustrating one for the whole scene there in Oklahoma, to say the least.
Definitely. Thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks, Logan.
Support for this Post Wrestling Podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
Logan Knight joining us, and Brandon, I mean, like, we've kind of talked about it with you in the past, but I mean, what were some of your kind of experiences in commission states when you were wrestling? Like, is it a general sentiment among a lot that it's oversight but not quite understanding what exactly the industry is or is not?
I guess so. I mean, the two states that I wrestled the most in were New York and Pennsylvania, which are both commission states. And I think we've probably talked about before, New York has a pretty restrictive commission that makes it pretty expensive for small time independent wrestling companies to run and put a lot of expenses on them, including a lot of things like medical insurance to cover wrestlers that is seldom ever used. And it's, I think it's kind of government bureaucracy not functioning well in a classic sense, in that they're applying a lot of regulations that aren't the regulations that the wrestlers, that the wrestling community feels like need to be applied, which I would say would be more like somehow ensuring that people are properly trained, as opposed to requiring promoters to bear a lot of expense, which reduces the number of shows, which reduces the any economic impact to the local Knights of Columbus and banquet halls and things like that, that host a lot of Inventor Wrestling events. That's my experience of it. Pennsylvania was a lot less restricted, which made it, as far as I know, less expensive to run there. It was just, you know, you didn't have to pay for all the things like the ambulance and the medical insurance and things like that. And I think there's an argument to be made about ensuring that there are certain medical requirements in terms of having a doctor there or having EMTs there, somebody who can provide medical service if there is an injury, which there often are injuries. And independent wrestlers don't tend to be the kinds of people who are insistent on getting the right kind of medical care. So I think that there's a strong argument that there should be some kind of requirement there, but it's in a lot of cases, it's just, you know, people are very disconnected from the wrestling industry who are more probably about regulating and overseeing boxing, which is a legitimate contest, and MMA as MMA has risen up in the last couple of decades.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a story that does have a tendency to repeat itself. I know here in the province of Ontario in Canada, this used to be,
yes,
a province that was regulated, and Lufisto was kind of,
still got it. Yeah. Yeah.
She was at the forefront and going through the same issues about like intergender wrestling. And, you know, it was considered a big thing when Ontario stopped overseeing professional wrestling. And again, like, I think like there are areas that could be positive oversight, but it tends to be a lot of overreach, and it just becomes a burden for a lot of these companies to even make it worth its while to be running shows, and it detracts rather than promotes running events. It has, yeah, the
there would be a place for it, but it's just often misapplied by people, mm-hmm, who don't have a strong understanding of a very strange business.
Let's fire through some other topics. It was a very busy week. The New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority. I'm sure they are getting acquainted with one, Brandon Thurston.
No, they are.
There was a report this week from the Bergen Record that it appears that over $7 million is being earmarked by the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority to secure the two-night SummerSlam event that is happening next summer at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, Jersey. The money coming from the American Rescue Plan, which was a stimulus package attached to a COVID-19 that New Jersey received from the federal government during the pandemic. The money can be used to, quote, respond to the negative economic impacts of the public health emergency by providing aid to impacted industries such as tourism, travel, and hospitality. And this is, you know, as Brandon has outlined, of some of these variances in site fees and incentives, this is one definitely on the higher end of things that we're looking at. Like, this is more than WrestleMania in Las Vegas. This is a significant amount that WWE is receiving for this two-night event.
Yeah, I'm hoping to do a more thorough report this week later, but we have two records that indicate what the value is that is being provided by the NJSEA, the New Jersey Sports and Exhibition Authority, which is a government entity. That's why we're able to make records requests here. And $7.1 million. You compare that to what we have, according to emails within Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas government, that they're providing $5 million. For a two-day WrestleMania. Here we have $7.1 million for a two-day SummerSlam. SummerSlam is a big event, and it's 2 days, but it's the third biggest event on WWE's calendar. Compare that to the Tampa St. Pete area that provided this year for Royal Rumble $500,000 for the second biggest event. So you have, yes, it's a one-day event, but you provided, a local tourism board provided $500,000 for that event, and it appears that the third biggest event is getting, what 14 times that. So I've got questions out to WWE and to the NJSEA if they can help me understand why there is such a difference. And maybe there's something, I'm sure these deals are complicated, and maybe there's something we just don't understand here, but it's a huge fee, which on, one hand, if you're a shareholder, you'll love to hear it. But why this much more than other events, that so that on a relative basis, this doesn't make a lot of sense.
And is this an aberration, or is this where things are trending when it comes to TKO and aggressively pursuing the site fees and being able to set the bar at a $7 million figure for a two-night event? Like, to me, if that's what you can get for a two-night WWE show, some of these larger UFC events, I would think, like, again, you have to find the states or locations that would be willing to pony this up. But all indications from TKO is that they are going to be just pushing and pushing for these significant fees. So we will see if this becomes.
And we know through my earlier reporting that in 2021, Las Vegas hosted SummerSlam and $330,000. And here we have what is more than 20 times that, I think.
Inflation.
Yes. We've lost your video, but yeah, it's a lot more. So, maybe there was just such a bidding war for this event that it made SummerSlam such a sought after event that that the price was run up here, but a very high price.
All right. I am here.
There you are. But, okay. Yeah, great.
This is backup camera. This is the second time this happens this week. Okay. So I apologize, everyone. Let's move on to our favorite topic, and that is television ratings. Let's start off with AEW. So after their big deal announcement, they came out with Rampage on Friday night, featuring a Young Bucks match, teaming with Jack Perry, finishing with 216,000 viewers and a 0.07 in the demo. This was their among their lowest numbers ever in their normal time slot on Friday night. Lowest since August the 2nd, 15th in primetime on cable, that going into the weekend. And then we had Collision on Saturday, which was a taped show airing against Bad Blood, airing against two MLB playoff games, college football, UFC 307 prelims, and they got walloped. 269,000 viewers and a 0.05 in the demo. That's down 60% from the previous week, which was the Grand Slam episode of Collision. 18 to 34 was just decimated. It fell 83% this week. 15,000 viewers in 18 to 34, second lowest viewership in its normal slot, and lowest ever in the regular slot in the key demo. So it was, back-to-back drubbings that these two shows took is my takeaway.
Collision was destroyed by Bad Blood, which Bad Blood, I think, ended just before Collision went off the air. So this is not completely going against Bad Blood, but
yeah,
large.
It went till about 9:30. So it would have been like the last half hour Collision would have had unopposed.
Yes. Yeah. And you do see that in the quarter hours, which I have on the Patreon, where there is a bit of an uptick in the latter part of Collision, but, you know, not nearly enough to avoid this being one of the lowest ratings ever for Collision.
And then over to WWE and SmackDown on Friday night, 1,518,000 viewers. And, they were down 3% in viewership, but up 4% in the demo. First on cable for the night, but number two on all of television as the war that we are willing into existence. Fox college football versus SmackDown. It was, the Michigan State Oregon game, topping all of television. But I mean, SmackDown beat college football on ESPN. They beat the two WNBA playoff games. So that is where things stood for SmackDown in Nashville on Friday night.
Yeah. And just looking at the line chart here, I think we're getting an idea. You know, we knew by episode two, I think, where SmackDown is regularly going to be. It's at about 1.5 million viewers. And it's about, what is this, in the high 4.0s in the demo. And it's regulated pretty quickly. Maybe there'll be a little bit of a recovery after there's no more college football competition on Friday, but this is where it's going to be, it looks like.
And what have you been able to determine for Monday's Raw numbers?
I can confirm that the first ever, well, the first in what, 14 years? No, 12 years. 12 years.
12 years.
Two-hour Raw, 1.545 million viewers, a 0.47 in the demo. It did the same demo rating as SmackDown. In fact, close to the same amount of viewership, a little bit higher. How does this compare to the prior week? It's up 2% in total viewership. It's down actually a little bit in the demo. There was a baseball game, playoff game, in addition to the Monday Night Football game that it usually goes against. So maybe harder competition here, but, I think that's consistent with what I tried to spell out on Monday afternoon, sort of saying, okay, what's the average of just the first 2 hours in the last year? And it would be about a 5% increase, 3 to 5% increase. And that's kind of what we saw. We saw something in that range of the low single digits versus the trailing 4 weeks.
Did you, I imagine you did not sit through a 2 hour edition of Raw. You're waiting for the 30 minute edition of Raw. Maybe
I did not. My apathy for modern wrestling content is strong.
Yeah, that's it's understood. It's very consistent. All right, and we're speaking to you before the Tuesday night gentlemen's agreement between AEW and NXT went down, but
just a 1 hour war this time, head to head.
Yeah, the 1 hour war between CW and TBS. But those numbers will be out later today. Follow him at Brandon Thurston. He will let you know who won, who's a draw, who's going out of business, who's on fire.
No, all this will be answered based spoiler. On. Nobody's going out of business. That's what's happening here.
You think both companies will be around next week?
They will. They'll both survive, I think.
All right. And one last story I just want to mention was earlier this week, not a development in the antitrust case, but we did have over 50 fighters in the Kung Lee case declare. Well, they made declarations in exhibits that were posted by the plaintiffs. And essentially, this is imploring Judge Richard Boulware to accept this updated settlement figure of $375 million. The original settlement was $335 million for both sets of classes. This is $375 just for the Kung Lee fighters, which competed between December of 2010 and June 30th of 2017. There's also a breakdown of what the amounts would be for some of these fighters, which it's significant money. But just going through some of these declarations from the fighters and trauma they've sustained, brain injuries, inability to work, it really just paints a very sad picture. And I don't know what Boulware's reaction will be, because on one hand, you could say, wow, these guys really need this money and they need this money now. The other side of it is, are we just setting the stage for another generation of fighters to be in this exact same spot 20 years from now, that if there are not significant changes to the way this business is operated, that
are fighters compensated a lot better than fighters of this era in the class?
There's definitely been increases in pay, but certainly not commensurate, I would say, to
where, enough to offset CTE.
I don't think so. No. Like, when you have all these people that are talking about their inability to afford health care and they can't work, I can't say like we're, this is a generation of fighters.
They have the UFC pension though, right? UFC pension plan.
Oh, a what? I'm not familiar with a
UFC 401k pension plan.
Yeah. None of those words have probably ever been uttered to a fighter, nor have percentage of a TV deal ever been dreamed about. Yeah, if you want to read some of these, like, they are pretty just sad to read the state of some of these fighters. But it's in Richard Boulware's court of whether, literally, if he will approve of this. And they still have to separately agree on the Cajun Johnson case, which becomes trickier because that is the one that does include injunctive relief that could change contracts. But you have all these fighters in the Cajun Johnson case that have signed on these waivers that really doesn't give them the ability to, you know, procure the level of financial compensation that the Kung Lee case gets.
And I did see this there, as you spoke about. There's a number of declarations from fighters who are members of the class, including Vanderlei Silva. Yep. And this is all of them saying, yes, we like this deal, basically,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And was that present in the previous settlement that was rejected?
I don't think they had any specific declarations from fighters, certainly not at this level, but you did have like the buy-in from fighters beforehand that they wanted this settlement.
But this is a tack that is being taken on this settlement that was not on the first rejected settlement.
Yeah. I mean, they're pushing very hard. Like, these are, and I don't doubt, like, these fighters are in great need of financial resources at the present and are not interested in a prolonged battle that could go as long as TKO wants to appeal and mm-hmm. run the risk of getting nothing at the end of this. Like, these are, like, you can see the breakdown, and I wrote a story about it on the site where you can see, like, the breakdown. I think John Nash did an estimate. The highest payout would be Anderson Silva, who stands to gain $10 million from this settlement. So, I mean, that's the very highest payout, but a very significant amount of fighters that are going to be getting, you know, $250,000, $500,000. So this is real money, not to say they would never have to work again, but it would be, for many of them, significant for their immediate needs. Okay. And there you go. That is you are now up to date on all the news that is going on. Brandon, anything you are that's going on in the pipeline? You are navigating the state of New Jersey as we speak.
Yeah. I guess we can imagine, this Kevin Kelly and Tay Twins case, not only revealing what the parent company of AEW is for what that's worth, and the note that no publicly traded company owns 10% or more, but did also reveal that that AEW has paid its talent in just over the trailing 2 year period, $60 million. So that's like comes out to roughly $30 million per year in each of the last 2 years. Which changes my financial estimates. Plug that right into your model. That does help make an argument that
they're going to be profitable.
According to what I was assuming prior, which was a higher talent cost, it gets them closer to it makes it harder for me to make math work where they're not profitable. And we should disclose this was according to a written declaration that was submitted as part of the lawsuit submitted by Chris Harrington, former WrestleNomics Radio co-host. In court, and it makes it easier to make the estimate, at least, but with one unit of measurement, and it along with the increase in TV rights fees, which is either $170 million or $185 million, depending on whether you're referencing Sports Business Journal or Variety and others. The AEW is probably going to be profitable. Sorry for people who don't want to hear that, though. They're probably going to be profitable.
Jumanji Hunter asks, could both parties request another judge? This in relation to the antitrust case. I don't know, because I would think that if this is, I think the original settlement, if that was an option, they would have sought that out because both sides were in agreement about the $335 million, and that was between both classes. So the fact is they are still like, I do not view Judge Boulware here as like a villain in this story. I think he is in some ways the biggest advocate for these fighters, but it is a riskier method of continuing to push this further. The reward could be greater, but so is the risk that they're looking for. Essentially, like, they want to cash out now and take the guarantee rather than continuing to go down this road and risk the idea of walking away with nothing. I get both sides here, but I don't view Boulware here as like this, you know, this villainous figure, even though he's going to be painted that way by some.
Yeah, I don't know, but I my question would be, is there precedent for this kind of rejecting of settlements when the situation is somewhat analogous to what the situation we have in this case?
It's very unique when you have both sides that are in agreement. It's the judge that is standing in the way of a settlement. All right, that's going to bring an end to the show. And you can catch WrestleNomics every Sunday this week at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Where can people send their questions to pick your brain, Brandon?
I should really create a new forwarding address, but they can send it for now to Brandon@WrestleNomics.com. That podcast I think we're going to do it on Sunday, regardless of Wrestle Dream, is going to be on Sunday for subscribers only at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. So I know this past week's episode was free for everyone, and it had a larger audience than usual. As all of the people, all the fine people across social media and the globe came out of the woodwork to engage about AEW's new media deal, which we discussed at length for most of 79 minutes. And you can listen to all that for free. But if you want to listen to this coming week's episode and those for the rest of the month, go to patreon.com/WrestleNomics and you get access to that, as well as all the TV ratings reports, court hour reports, and more.
And over at postwrestlingcafe.com, earlier this week, we put out a really great breakdown of the Queen of Villains series on Netflix with Karen Peterson and JP Houlihan from the Grapple Spotlight podcast. That is up now. And Wei and I are going to be doing a mailbag show on Thursday, answering any and all questions. We always welcome questions, whether it's Brandon or myself or Wei Ting. So all of that can be found, again, postwrestlingcafe.com and WrestleNomics.com. Check them out. And thank you to both Kendra Barkoff Lammy and Logan Knight for joining us on the show. A double guest day here on Pollock and Thurston. We will be back next Wednesday, where we are each and every week, 1 p.m. Eastern time. What will the big story be next week? That's the big question, Brandon. What's going to break over the next 7 days? Any
predictions? I'm not going to make any. That's too dangerous to guess.
Okay. Everyone will still be in business. That's one safe prediction. Yes, but we thank all of you for joining us, as always.